Hello everyone and welcome to the second session of our seminar series on Palestinian agricultural development between colonialism, globalization and liberation. My name is Fadia Panosetti and I'm one of the organizers of this seminar series together with Ahmad Aneti, Tahir Labadi, Natalie Salame and in collaboration with the French Institute of the Near East, the Margaret and Stis Center for Global Studies at the University of Cambridge and the Institute for Palestine Studies. Before we start, just a quick note that we are recording this session. Also, today's session will be conducted in English, but simultaneous translation in Arabic is available. So if you want to access the translation, you can select your preferred language from the box located at the bottom of your Zoom page. Our translator, Manar, will be with us for the first part of the session and for part of the discussion. The discussion will be both in Arabic and in English, and the idea is to make everyone feel comfortable in the language they prefer to speak. So please feel free to ask questions in the language of your choice, either in Arabic or in English. We will try to manage the Q&A in both Arabic and English, also after Manar will leave. It will probably not be easy to manage the two languages together, but we have made this choice because we really want to encourage your participation in the discussion. Now that the logistical details are sorted, let's proceed with a brief introduction to this seminar series. Palestinian agricultural development between colonialism, globalization, and liberation is a seminar series on the past, present, and future of agriculture in Palestine. As we witness the ongoing destruction of Palestinian agriculture, exacerbated by decades of settler colonial dispossession, economic policies that have fostered dependency on Israeli and international markets, and most recently, the genocidal war on Gaza, it is more urgent than ever that we refocus our attention on this crucial sector. The Palestinian agricultural sector does in fact remain crucial for the struggle for land, for livelihoods and for collective liberation. This seminar series aims to be a space for scholars and practitioners in the field of Palestinian agriculture to discuss and exchange on these questions. In particular, we aim to explore how, on the one hand, violent processes of colonial dispossession and neoliberalism have shaped the Palestinian agricultural sector over the last decades. And on the other hand, we would like to explore the forms of struggle that have emerged in, against, and beyond these structural processes, as well as the future that these struggles envision. So we started the seminar series around 4 weeks ago with an introductory session, and the seminar will now run until the end of June 2024. We really would like to encourage your participation to as many sessions as possible so that we can get to know each other and to continue the conversation on this issue, so on Palestinian agriculture and agricultural development together throughout the duration of the seminar. Our plan is to continue having this seminar also in the fall, so please do reach out if you are an early career scholar working on Palestinian agriculture and you would like to present your work in the autumn. Also, we might consider working on a collective book or another collective project as a follow-up to this seminar series. And so we invite those of you who might be interested in it to explore this possibility with us. Now, without any further delay, I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today's session, Faik Marai, who will present his work on youth agricultural cooperatives in the Palestinian Central Highlands. Faik is an architect, teacher, and researcher. In his research, he focuses on the speciality of Palestinian anti-colonial and socioeconomic struggle. His current work focuses on mashak, or collectivity of labor and property, within Palestinian resistance, both in thought and in practice. Faik is currently a doctoral fellow at the Institute for the History and Theory of Architecture at the ETH Zurich. Before joining this institute, he practiced architecture and taught at the universities of Birzeit and Al-Quds in Palestine. He holds a bachelor's degree in architectural engineering from the University of Birzeit and a master's in architectural history and theory from the University of Michigan, where he was a Fulbright scholar. Last but not least, Faik is also an editor of the magazine Arab Urbanism. Faik, it's such a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you for joining us. You have now 30 minutes for your presentation, and then we will move on to the Q&A. So please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Fadia, for the introduction, and thank you and all the team for initiating this series and for inviting me. The first session was really a pleasure, and I hope that today will continue and we'll have a discussion, like a fruitful one, afterwards. I will start by sharing my screen. So 1 second. Okay. So this presentation is titled Youth Agricultural Cooperatives in the Palestinian Central Highlands, the West Bank, a model emerging from the contradictions of peripheralization. And this is part of the work I'm doing in my PhD, which I'm finishing up now. And it's somewhat of a work in progress. So the work has slightly moved on from what is mentioned here, but it also means that there is room for development and for discussion, and maybe we can talk more about this later. So let me start. In the 2010s in the West Bank, several economic or productive initiatives of collective labor and property emerged. They came to call themselves cooperatives. This presentation argues that these cooperatives emerged from the contradictions of the current phase of Zionist colonization in the West Bank, and specifically what I term peripheralization. In short, the destruction of the productive capacities of the Palestinian economy proletarianized the population and led to the neglect of large swaths of agricultural land. This has intersected with the obstruction of political mobilization under the joint repression of the Zionist regime and the Palestinian Authority. Large sectors of society thus faced double alienation, political and economic. Faced from within this situation, a sector of left-leaning youth perceived need along with opportunity and utilized fellow towards an alternative economy.
Sorry to interrupt you. We can see your text in the slides. So you didn't manage to put your slides on full screen.
Okay, I will.
Yeah. And okay. Also, we would like to ask you if you can speak a bit slower, because we have simultaneous translation. So for Manar, sure. Otherwise it's too hard to follow. Sure.
I think now it's fine, right?
Now it's good. Now it's good. Okay. Thank you.
So what I was saying is that large sectors of society thus faced double alienation, political and economic. And from within this situation, a sector of left-leaning youth perceived need along with opportunity and utilized fallow lands towards an alternative economy in an effort to respond to the entanglement of capitalism and Zionist colonialism in Palestine today as they saw it. These initiatives correspond to the political and economic conditions aforementioned and relate to the concept of resistance economy, which emerged in the same decade as an intellectual response to this reality. This presentation traces the outlines of peripheralization in the West Bank, posing a view where the peripheralization of the West Bank's countryside as an urban phenomenon is understood as part of the colonial and imperial peripheralization of Palestine and the Arab region as a whole. It follows the practices of those cooperatives, as well as their organizational and intellectual imbrications, to make its argument. It ends by highlighting the importance of these cooperative experiments, their emerging practice as it toils to understand and respond to the capital colonial nexus in Palestine, is productive for theory and practice in this context and elsewhere. So let's talk a bit more about the cooperatives themselves. As I mentioned, in the mid-2010s, several collective economic initiatives were founded, and these included two cultural coffee shops and a farm that were organized around egalitarian principles and with a vision of social and political commitment. Those were in Ramallah and around Ramallah as well, in Bir Zeit. Influenced by those three experiments, between the years 2018 and 2021, 16 other agricultural cooperatives were founded, a bulk of which during the COVID-19 lockdown, all operating in close connection to each other, brought together by a local NGO that facilitated exchange between grassroots groups in Palestine. These 16 cooperatives focus on food production, mainly vegetables and wheat, but also olives and other produce. One cooperative is a plant nursery and another is a poultry farm. Now, in discussions with the founders of those cooperatives, what was mentioned as contributing to their founding were one, return to the land, unemployment, seeking a collaborative work environment, protecting the land from Zionist settlement, and establishing a resistance economy. And what they pronounce is that the values that animate them are care, justice and equality, productivity, independence, and that they apply them to relations with society at large, including consumers, relations of production, management, and relations with the land and the ecology. Now, to take a step away from what the cooperatives say about themselves, we can start analyzing the emergence of these cooperatives in relation to a number of trends in the West Bank, and we can start with the political economy. So, to talk about peripheralization, in dependency theory, peripheries are economies that are conditioned to facilitate the development of core economies, which are advanced capitalist nations, based on relationships of unequal exchange. Peripheralization would thus be the shaping of a nation's economy as a periphery, facilitated by various means of domination and coercion. Accordingly, we can read the history of the West Bank economy as peripheralization in phases, where in the first phase, immediately after the occupation of the West Bank in 1967, Israel incorporated its economy, the West Bank's economy, and oriented production towards Israeli, Jordanian, and European markets. In the second phase, starting in 1976, Israel began uprooting the productive factors in the West Bank through land expropriation, tax hikes, and other legal and violent means, thus reducing the West Bank into a market and a labor source. In the third phase, starting in the 1980s, with the internationalization of Israeli capital and the neoliberalization of Israeli and Arab economies, the peripheralization of the West Bank came to serve wider circuits of capital accumulation. First, through what I may call formal incorporation, in the sense that Palestinian labor and market would now serve the internationally oriented Israeli capital and foreign investments in Israel. But then more substantially, since the 1990s, through the creation and facilitation of investment opportunities in the West Bank by the Palestinian Authority. Now, as Adam Haniyeh shows, this whole process has been part of imperial efforts to peripheralize the Arab region as a whole, maintaining its hydrocarbons and trade routes under control and producing it as a space conducive to circuits of capital accumulation in the imperial course through trade deficits, debt, and aid. And here Israel plays the role of empire's loyal policeman in the region and relatedly its most advanced economy. The manner in which this peripheralization of the Palestinian economy in the West Bank was achieved depended on different colonial policies, foremost of which is lethal violence, segregation, dispossession of land and resources, legal tools, securitization and oppression, often made possible by various guises of self-rule. Its ultimate goal has been the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And this has been captured, or much of it has been captured in the literature through the concept of Bantustanization, such as in the work of Leila Farsa. But here I would like to expand beyond the economy and introduce another definition of peripheralization that can help us better conceptualize the entanglement of the roles of the colonial state, the PA, and capital more generally, and explain the varying manifestations of economic domination across Palestinian space. So to take from Henri Lefebvre's conception of peripheralization, for him, peripheralization is a formative process of urbanization, the articulation of central and peripheral spaces that mediate the social order. And so it fits within the three phenomena of capital: homogenization, fragmentation, and hierarchization, which occur at all scales in the planet. It includes the unequal division of power, wealth, material and spiritual exchange, leisure and information. And so peripheries are spaces of surveillance and repressive control. The centers dominate the peripheries and fragment them, coordinate them, and submit them to the global strategy of the state. And Lefebvre was thinking about this mainly through France and the relationship between Paris and the French peripheries, but also within Paris itself, the core of the city, and then the banlieues on the outside. But he kind of extrapolated that and viewed the center-periphery relations at the city, national, regional, or global levels as all forms of colonization that can be linked. Now, this sweeping conceptualization might not be completely satisfactory, yet in the case of the West Bank, the nesting of the countryside as a periphery on all those levels is clear, and the relationship between them, in my opinion, is important. And so the reason basically why I try to understand the condition through the concept of peripheralization here is to make a link between what we can read in the relationship between the Palestinian countryside and Palestinian cities, but also the countryside and the colonial centers, and to understand the role of capital as part of both phenomena. So if we look at the West Bank today, it is an archipelago of non-sovereign Palestinian enclaves, circumscribed Palestinian population centers surrounded by Area C, which forms 60% of the West Bank under full Israeli control. It is also surrounded by Israeli settlements and infrastructure and the apartheid wall. These enclaves are heavily policed and surveilled to ensure that resistance does not pose a threat to the colony, its economy, and the daily life of its settlers. Area C, which is rich in resources, is controlled and exploited by Israel. Israeli restrictions and dispossession, as well as since the 1990s, the neoliberalization of the Palestinian economy by the Palestinian Authority, have marginalized the productive sectors therein, prominent of which is agriculture. Between 1965 and 1994, 30% of agricultural land in the West Bank ceased production, and the share of agriculture in the West Bank's GDP fell from 34.8% in 1970 to less than 16% in the year 2000. The end result is an agricultural sector that acts as a reservoir of labor, a fallback sector that Palestinians have repeatedly turned to at times of reduced access to Israeli labor markets or at times of crisis more generally. And here we can see the effect on agricultural employment specifically in the last three decades. Now, this has entailed the proletarianization of the Palestinian population, where 70% are wage laborers, a majority of which is now a reserve army of labor, swinging between precarious employment in the Israeli market, around a quarter, and Palestinian labor market, 66%, half of which lack job contracts, and unemployment, which is around 14%. A significant portion work in the PA's public sector, half of them in security, policing the rest, basically. While Palestinian public and private sectors are ultimately funded by international aid, taxes, and financial devices, They consume Israeli products or ones imported through Israel and have since 2007 been pushed towards consumer credit by the PA. But these phenomena have manifested themselves differentially across Palestinian space. Job opportunities for both public and private sectors in the Palestinian labor market are concentrated in major urban centers, particularly Ramallah, the de facto capital of the PA, and so are spaces of consumption as well as cultural, health, and public institutions. And here we can see in the graph the percentage of workers whose work space is in their locality of residence. And it is very obvious that the urban centers have the highest of this concentration, while the rural and camp populations have the lowest. And it's also obvious that it is decreasing. A major portion of the Palestinian proletariat resides in the villages and commutes to urban centers, both Palestinian and colonial, thus turning the villages into dormitory towns rather than productive units. Great swaths of land still accessible in the countryside lay fallow or minimally cultivated, much of it formulating a speculative land market. The countryside has thus become peripheral to the urban centers, both Palestinian and colonial. While this in itself reflects the peripheralization of the Palestinian economy and space as a whole to the colonial Israeli one. On the other hand, the internationalization of capital, both in the Israeli and Palestinian markets, mean that the exploitation of these workers, as well as their domination, serves global capital, while the suppression of Palestinian resistance as a whole, again directly tied to all above, ensures that Israel is able to play its role dominating the region. These are the conditions in which this group of cooperatives was born and to which they sought to respond. And if we take one village as an example, we can see these more clearly. So Safa is the village where the first of the 16 cooperatives mentioned were founded. 20% of its land was lost to Zionist militias during the war in 1948. Of the remaining 80%, 87.1% is in Area C. Most agricultural land is there where Israeli permissions are required for operation, lacking infrastructure and the adequate means to basically cultivate. 23% of Safa's area was confiscated for the construction of 8 Israeli settlements, housing 22,000 settlers. And now 55.7% of Safa's land lay beyond the apartheid wall. If we look at labor data, in 2010, 30% of Safa's workforce worked in Israel or Israeli settlement. While between 2010 and 2017, in the West Bank in general, Palestinian labor in Israel and its settlements increased by 50%, indicating a higher percentage in Safa today. Or not really today, because now it's not possible, but just before the war. And only 15% of Safa's workforce worked in agriculture in 2010, while 15% were unemployed. Now, numbers for sure differ in other villages, but they indicate similar dynamics. In Beit Sira, for example, just to the south, where 57% of its lands were confiscated in 1948, 78% of the village's workforce worked in Israeli settlements in 2010. Now, the cooperatives really reflect this reality. So, if we talk about labor, half of the cooperative members here cited unemployment as a motivation for founding their cooperative, while others cited either alienation in their jobs or refusal or inability to work in the Israeli labor market. More specifically, half of these cooperatives were founded during the COVID lockdown and its aftermath, which raised unemployment and lack of access to labor, Israeli labor markets increased. Now, this clearly reflects the dynamics aforementioned. In four cooperatives, all members are fully employed in the cooperative and depend on it for income. In the rest, members work part-time in the cooperative on the side of another job or on the side of their studies. One cooperative regularly employs wage laborers, while one other has done so at specific occasions. The rest do not. In some cooperatives, members' families contribute with uncompensated labor. Mainly, this is done by female family members and focuses on marketing. Other cooperatives refuse such help, while others' families are not able to offer it. And the same goes for volunteer work. And so these cooperatives reflect a pattern repeatedly observed in the political economy of the West Bank and Gaza, as mentioned, where agriculture acts as a fallback economic activity. To further support this observation, it is to be noted that in the villages of those cooperatives, others turn to agriculture and to collective forms therein specifically during the same period. Now, if we talk about land, the total area held by each cooperative ranges between 1 to 14 dunams. The parcels themselves are small and dispersed. Most cooperatives have begun with lands held by a member's family or relative, which were given to the cooperative to use for no return. Others borrowed land from non-relatives in their village, while some started out on rented lands with rent ranging from $30 to $300 per dunam per year. And most cooperatives eventually rented land. Now, the ease with which the cooperatives were able to find lands to borrow or rent, or olive groves to lease, along with the difficulty they faced in reclaiming them, and the fact that much of it was held by these members' families, indicates the condition of fallow land and lowly productive agricultural land in the villages. Indeed, as mentioned by many members in interviews, villagers were happy to offer land with fee or without as baraka, just so that it doesn't lie fallow. The size of these land holdings also reflects the fragmentation of the land holdings in the West Bank. Most cooperatives hold lands in Area C, while another sizable portion is in Area B. And here we see that in cooperatives in Safa and Kfar Na'me in Ramallah, and also in the cooperatives near Nablus in Sarra, Burin, Madama, and Asir al-Qibliya. And here we see that almost half of the lands are in Area C in light gray, the other half in Area B. And yet, while land was available, it was mostly far from water sources and agricultural roads or dangerously close to Zionist settlements. This reflects the conditions that have led to the deterioration of the agricultural sector in the West Bank and labor therein. It is also worth noting that the majority of the 16 cooperatives are founded in hilly villages where agriculture is rain-fed and which have not traditionally been food baskets for the Palestinian people. This indicates that the availability of land for cooperatives might be linked to its low productivity. In other words, its infeasibility for the agribusiness model that is otherwise growing in fertile Palestinian areas in the West Bank, such as in the plains, in the Jordan Valley, and in the north. And here we can see the same cooperatives over a layer of the agricultural value of land as per the layers of geomorg. And from here, we can see that most of the cooperative lands are actually in medium value agricultural lands. And if we look at the West Bank, where the high value lands are, there is little to basically no cooperative of the ones I'm mentioning that are there. But it would be a mistake to explain these forms, i.e. the cooperatives, economistically. In certain respects, they do correspond directly to economic conditions, as was just explained. On the other hand, and apart from the activist history of some cooperative members, when economic conditions got better, these cooperatives maintained their operation despite better paying alternatives. Furthermore, at the time those cooperatives were founded, others from the same social circles as some cooperative members went towards entrepreneurship, which again indicates an unstable or alienating labor market, but also highlights the particularity of the cooperative path. This indicates that it was not only directly felt economic factors that led to the emergence of these cooperatives and gives credence to the claims made by their members as to larger social and political goals. Goals proclaimed by these cooperatives, a resistance economy, a return to the land, land defense, and others, tie neatly to emergent thought in the 2000s and 2010s. Academic and policy literature, mainly in English, term it as resistance economy or development as resistance. It grew among urban middle class and intellectuals, along with the rise in the financialization and the increasing clarity of the articulation between neoliberalism and colonialism in Palestine. Non-academic writing also grappled with similar ideas, notably Basil al-A'raj, who wrote about the economy of the First Intifada and worked to revive historical practices of resistance, of which the socioeconomic was one. Indeed, those cooperatives had direct contact with a number of these authors and institutions, such as Bisan Institute and Adel Samara, and read others like Tariq Da'na and Basil al-A'raj. But as Noor Arafi argues, the neologism of resistance economy, one showed little contrast to the 1970s and 80s literature on Sumud steadfastness as development, and two, it was vaguely defined. The similarity to older discourse can also help explain why it was particularly those cooperative founders that were drawn to this rhetoric and to those ideas. And here we can talk about the heritage of organization. So the founders of the 16 cooperatives have indirect ties to PLO parties, specifically leftist ones. A number of them have been political prisoners, others are banned from the Israeli labor market on security bases, while many were active in leftist student organizations, while others have been involved in cultural institutions in their villages that have a leftist tint. Indeed, many of those members were members of village volunteer committees that harken back to those of the left since the 1970s. The cooperatives built directly on this model, but what differentiates them today is their quest to combine members' material need with their socio-political goals, becoming both a source of income and a vehicle for social contribution to local community. Within their incubator organization, it was the leftists that were drawn to the cooperative model. This reflects both an economic need, as those people are less likely to find employment in the public sector, for example, as well as thought. And it is no surprise that the cooperatives were born within an NGO incubator. The left had long been imbricated in the NGO sector. At the same time, the move towards grassroots social and economic groups, with cooperatives being one form, indicates the inability to organize and undertake such social welfare provision or struggle within classical political structures under the repression of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank today and Israel. So now let's talk about basically what has happened with time with those experiments. Now, along the emergence of the 19 cooperatives in total that were mentioned here, the practice of collective land and labor among those youth has moved from corresponding predominantly to political and ideological concerns to more material and economic ones. This can be seen from the composition of the cooperatives. The founders of the earlier three cooperatives had stable jobs or the opportunity to obtain ones, while with the more recent cooperatives, members were unemployed. The former were based in cities, while the latter in villages. It can also be seen in the goals and motivations each cooperative has mentioned for their work. Furthermore, even within the same cooperative, members' understanding of themselves and their goals shifted with time towards the economic. This transition may be considered as a maturation of the experience, a movement from the abstract to the concrete, from perception of a general economic and political necessity to actual need. But with this transition, the contradictions lying within this experiment have also risen to the surface. Between the economic imperatives, the attempts at conceiving of an alternative form of living and labor conducive to liberation, and the political structures corresponding to political repression in the West Bank, these cooperatives operate and display contradictory positions between and among themselves. For example, while the earlier cooperatives categorically refused NGO funding and announced this as a main tenet and impetus for their founding, the ones that remain in operation of the three moved to accept unconditional funding. The later formed cooperatives were even more lenient in this regard, taking grants that earlier co-ops refused, sometimes to detrimental effects. Now, this can be explained by economic need, reflecting the class position of newer members who are therefore more willing to compromise. But moreover, The newer cooperatives were founded by people who are closer to the traditional organization of the left, in a sense less critical of and more involved with existing practices, of which NGO funding is one. At the same time, even among the cooperatives that were formed in response to economic necessity, some members find difficulty marrying market imperatives with their social goals or their romantic drive with the capitalist reality they find themselves in. In a discussion on the practice of the most profitable of the 16 cooperatives, another's member explained, "Let's just be volunteer and community work committees. You are making me feel as if we are a private company." She had previously stated that her cooperative generates ample produce, but they can never get themselves to sell it. Instead, they hand it out for free. Now, this is not a generalizable case among those 19 cooperatives, but it points to the varying degrees and directions of development in the thought of the cooperatives. It is notable that this particular cooperative I just mentioned was then one of the ones most keen on obtaining NGO funds. And in general, they operate more like a charity. And I have to maybe say now that the fieldwork that this builds on was undertaken between 2021 and 2022, and the conditions now are slightly different, just to keep that in mind. But in general, the discussion reflects a yet underdeveloped conception of what success would mean for those cooperatives. Similar to what Arafa has noted on the intellectual plane, resistance economy in practice is also vaguely defined. Some cooperatives operate with a market-oriented notion, aiming to accumulate capital that would remain a property of the cooperative as an ethical business, and part of it which is channeled back to the local community. But even one such cooperative is grappling with the issue of compensation to cooperative members, saying that if they calculate an hourly wage to members, the cooperative would never be profitable. This particular issue, labor and remuneration, remains a point of debate within and among cooperatives. Cooperatives discuss fairness, a wage based on hours or on effort, how to quantify such effort. Some cooperatives employ wage laborers. One does so at market rates and cite the goal of providing job alternatives to the Israeli labor market as justification. Others refuse to employ wage labor, citing their own principles. But interestingly, those are cooperatives whose members are fully dependent in their income on the cooperative. A similar split is noticeable around uncompensated family and volunteer labor, which the cooperatives of fully dependent members refuse again. One cooperative member likened his cooperative to a family, mostly indicating affection and care. But indeed, they also show other traits of small peasant farming families, such as self-exploitation. Recently, one cooperative is starting to think of itself as lying beyond the market and trying to conceive its success or failure in non-market terms while providing for the livelihood of its members and supporting its village. Now, the idea itself was not new. It had existed since the early days of the founding of these cooperatives, but the attempts at implementing it are becoming more advanced. Furthermore, while these cooperatives are partially driven by romantic sentiment of returning to the land, a question of production, one can say, in their operation, they increasingly find themselves needing to focus more on the other moments of value realization, on circulation, logistics, and on consumption. Now, at the same time, this movement to the concrete, as I have called it, has also involved the development of new ways to correspond to the political economy of the West Bank and meet the original goals. One such attempt has been the plan for a solidarity fund between the cooperatives, to which each will contribute regularly and which will accept individual donations, and only up to 15% of its capital will be from institutional donations. Basically, a compromise between the need for capital and the principle of departure from NGO funding. Another move is the consolidation of three proximate cooperatives into one, which grew out of necessity. And another is the shift towards fruit tree farming. In two cooperatives, the members realized that fallow lands, while technically available, are not really conducive to field crops or vegetables. They effectively emulated the dominant practice that accompanied the shift away from intensive agriculture in the highlands, namely olive cultivation, but took it a step further by planting other fruit trees. Such trees are rain-fed. They need only minimal maintenance and seasonal labor. This means that the cooperatives are spatially and temporally freed from multiple limitations that they heretofore incur. They can benefit from fallow lands that are farther away from their village centers, lacking water resources, whose owners are even more likely to lend or which will be cheaper to rent. They will also need to dedicate less time to cultivate these trees, meaning that they can increase their production or dedicate time to other practices like marketing. At the same time, these two cooperatives have been considering expanding operations to the Jordan Valley, one of the historically fertile flatlands of large landholdings in Palestine, and a place where agribusiness is quickly replacing sharecropping and small-scale farming. In many ways, the cooperatives are adopting practices already existing in society, whether solidarity practices or capitalist agriculture, developing and figuring their way between the two while revisiting their original goals and assumption. This revisitation often took the form of collective deliberations on capitalism and alternatives to it, the true potential of agriculture in Palestine, and what collectivity is or can be today. And I think that these cooperatives, in their practice, by asking those questions and trying to answering them, are really doing us all a favor in this quest of exploration. So in conclusion, the cooperatives discussed in this presentation have emerged, as I have argued, from the contradictions of the West Bank's political economy today. Peripheralization, particularly as expressed in the agricultural sector, proletarianization of the workforce, repression and securitization, and dispossession in a confluence of colonial and PA policies. These phenomena, as I have said, produced alienated Palestinian youth and fallow lands, a sector of politically motivated youth who believed in the imbrication of the colonization and the neoliberal economy sought alternatives. A new economy was thought to be needed not only socially, but also to breach the political horizon. In fallow land, they found possibility and set up cooperatives. Those were markedly leftist ones, ideologically, rhetorically, and in their NGO imbrication. Yet they also show the attempts of a new left to move away from these limitations while still tripping over them. But again, this was not purely an ideologically motivated phenomenon. Agriculture and collective forms of labor emerged as viable practices in the West Bank around the same period, indicating the economic imperative behind the practice. Again, this reflects a frequently observed pattern within the Palestinian economy whereby agriculture has acted as a fallback activity at times of crisis. And indeed, even within the ideologically motivated youth, as the practice grew, the demography, space, concerns, and practices of the cooperative members shifted more towards material concerns. This, I argued, reflects a maturation of the thought and the practice of these cooperatives as they move to reflect more accurately the possibilities and limitations of this model. Now, the trends that led to the rise of this model are only increasing in the West Bank today. The attempts of these groups to grapple with this reality while developing their understanding of the articulation of late capitalism and colonization, groping through their own practice for an overarching theory, is important. It's important, in my opinion, because one, while building on the Palestinian revolutionary tradition, they offer an original revisitation of the relationship between the economic and the political, and between productive production and social reproduction in colonized Palestine today. And two, by doing so, they could expose progressive possibilities within the contradictions of the contemporary Palestinian condition, but also the limitations therein. And three, as such, they contribute to a growing current of thought and mobilization for alternatives to capitalism and a better future for the planet, aptly from Palestine, in a stage of capitalism that Samir Amin had termed global apartheid. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Faik, for this wonderful and thought-provoking presentation. I think we can now open the floor for discussion. Please, anyone who has questions, you can drop them in the Q&A box. You can write them either in Arabic or in English, and we will read them aloud. So while waiting for people to formulate their questions, I think that I already have one. I mean, I have many questions, and I really enjoyed the way you presented the subject and the way you present those cooperatives as an heterogeneous movement and the people involved in this movement as coming from different backgrounds, different social classes, and also the way this cooperative movement, even though it is quite young, has been already changing in the last years. So my question would be more on the question of marketing. So you mentioned here and there the question of selling those products, and actually the question of marketing, it's one of the main challenges for Palestinian farmers and producers who have to compete with Israeli products that are sold on the Palestinian, actually are dumped into the Palestinian market at very low prices. And so I was wondering, those cooperatives, if they have developed new way of marketing. I know that there is some of those cooperatives have adopted a community supported agricultural model, but I was wondering, do they, like, at a certain point you mentioned some of those products are distributed in the village, do they sell them to rural areas in the village, in the urban? So if you can tell us a bit more about the marketing. And then just very tiny, very technical question, which is, do they register those cooperatives officially with the Palestinian Authority or not? Thank you.
Thank you, Fadia, for the questions. Okay, to start with marketing, there are multiple ways that they employ, and I think maybe I'm going to start with the implication of your question, because what you're asking is that marketing is a problem that many farmers face, and so could we learn something from the techniques that those cooperatives are practicing? And I think we can, but we also have to take into consideration the volume of production of those cooperatives. They remain small, and therefore I don't think that the solutions that they have found would necessarily scale up or would necessarily work exactly the same for the general farmer population, but I think a lot can be learned from them. Now, to talk specifically, from what I know and until now, even after years of operation, the cooperatives market first and foremost in their own villages locally, and they circumvent middlemen. So they do not sell, mostly they do not sell to wholesalers and to Al-Hisbe sometimes. So this is one. A lot of it is direct marketing. As I mentioned, this is largely done by female family members, uncompensated, but also a lot of it through Facebook and through the friends of the members of the cooperatives and so on. Now, importantly, they have urban selling points as well, such as في مركز الفن الشعبي, for example, in Ramallah, where a lot of them bring their produce and do the حسبة التعاونيات every week or every so weeks. And this creates also a selling point that also frees them from middlemen, because basically the institution, the NGO here, acts as a middleman that is, you know, a fair one rather than an exploitative one. So this is another way. But as you said also, community-supported methods are also used. Some of them sell baskets. They also, some of them donate food baskets for the poor in their villages and so on. Also, others have been selling in neighboring villages, like on the roadside. So I think that there are various methods that they have planned, and I think they work differently for different locations and for different volumes of production. But I think there is potential in all of those. One other, yeah, and I think a few of them had been planning to get a car in order to deliver those produce either in neighboring villages or to the city. So this is another point. Now, around registration, most of them are not registered, but some of them do. And the reason for registration is usually to get the funds that otherwise they could not get. So sometimes there would be a donor-initiated project which asks for, you know, it has certain stipulations of which formal registration is one. And so then they are compelled to register, which then also places much more, you know, bureaucratic constraints on them. And as I said, it kind of counters the initial aim of the earlier cooperatives and kind of mires them back into a model that had existed for a while, actually, since the 80s with, or even before, with Palestinian cooperatives and community-based organizations. But this remains limited. I think in this group, yeah, the number of cooperatives that are formally registered is limited.
Thank you very much for your answers. So now we have a question from Mariette, who really enjoyed your presentation. And she asks if there is any worker representation inside these cooperatives. So I think she would like to know if there is a kind of like trade union or like way in which those workers are represented, and if this representation is sector-based or. And yeah, if it's part of a federation, is in that independent, actually, yeah, if you have information on this subject.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if I mentioned this at the beginning, but these are small cooperatives, basically between, you can say, 4 members and 20. So, and they are largely informal. And actually, in like in another part of the work, I argue that even the word cooperative is largely rhetorical here. As you said, they are not registered, and they are more like committees, or maybe you can call them commons or something. And the word cooperative is not in the legal sense a cooperative. And they don't, mostly they do not own capital. They have, the lands are borrowed, they are, some of them are rented, but in general, most of them are not, as I said, like legally a cooperative. And they are, you know, worker run anyway. So as far as I know, there isn't such worker representation within them or in broader bodies. Now, I might add that probably a few of the members of the cooperatives and the Sharake are with us in this session in the audience, so maybe they can also intervene in the question and answer, or, you know, intervene otherwise.
Thank you so much. So now we have a question in Arabic, and I will let Natalie read it for us.
Thank you, Shadia. It is a question from. I'm going to check. Okay. The question is, how can we measure the success of this cooperative? Is it simply by the idea of retaining to the land, or is there a need for them to be economically viable? And how can we define economic viability for Palestinian under occupation? In the light of the contradiction, they live in between high cost of living and high consumption, and the call for a resistance economy, which is more to meeting the need of to the meaning of meeting the need for food. Thank you.
شكرا. هو احنا قلنا اللي بيجي بالعربي بدنا نجاوبه بالعربي، صح؟ طيب، شكرا على السؤال. يعني برأيي هو سؤال مهم، وبتخيل كل حدا من هاي التجربة راح يكون عنده جواب مختلف، بس أنا تقديري الفكرة إنه نفهم شو الإمكانيات وشو الحدود لتجربة زي هيك. يعني السؤال بالنسبة إلي، السؤال الأكبر هو قديش ممكن تعميمها أو قديش ممكن تكبر. من ناحية عدد الأعضاء، من ناحية مساحة الأراضي، ومن ناحية قطاعات مختلفة كمان برا الزراعة، بس بدنا نحكي هون تحديدا في الزراعة. هلا أنا رأيي في محدودية لوين ممكن تكبر، وبصفي السؤال ضمن هذا الحد كيف ممكن نحقق يعني الأهداف اللي ممكن تحقيقها. تصوري بصراحة إنه ممكن تساعد في حماية الأرض، ممكن تساعد بفكرة تغيير الفكر نوعا ما عن الأرض كسلعة، ويعني نفكر في الأرض كفائدة عامة للمجتمع، اللي يعني واضح إنه اليوم يعني إذا كان حدا شاكك أو مطنش، يعني هلأ بطل في إمكانية الواحد يطنش إنه إحنا مجتمع اللي عم بيتعرض للإبادة، وهذا هو هدف المستعمر تجاهنا، وبالتالي وجودنا وثباتنا على هذا الأرض هو الهدف الأهم. هلأ إذا في حدا بفكر إنه ممكن يطلع مصاري خلال هذا الحكي، أظن عم نوصل لمرحلة إنه نفهم إنه هذا الحكي على حساب وجودنا نفسه. بس يعني الرأسمالية ودوافعها قوية، يعني شو بدنا نعمل؟ فبصفي هون يعني سؤال، هاي التجارب هل هي تقدر تكبر ولا راح تضلها على الهامش؟ أنا رأيي إنه زي ما حكيت هي ممكن تساعد بالحفاظ على الأرض، هي ممكن تساعد بتوفير فرص عمل، ممكن تساعد بتوفير أمان غذائي، ولكن برأيي ضمن هوامش معينة. واللي بتصور ممكن ينجح ومش متأكد، بس بحب نعمل يعني بحث تقني شوي أكتر على هذا الموضوع. اللي أنا شايفه إنه مع تجربة التعاونيات من الأشياء المهمة اللي انبنت هي الثقة، سواء ثقة الأعضاء ببعض أو ثقة المجتمع في التعاونية اللي موجودة ضمن هاي القرية. وممكن هذا ينبنى عليه، بمعنى إنه إذا هذه المجموعات زادت ثقة المجتمع المحلي فيها أكثر، ممكن يصير في ناس أكثر مستعدة تعطيها أراضيها. فالأراضي اللي موجودة هلأ في الريف، وهي سواء متروكة لسبيكيوليشن يعني لسوق عقاري، على القليلة قبل ما تنباع ممكن يتم استغلالها. وضمن الهامش هذا اللي إحنا مش عم نتخيل إنه أوكي رح نقضي على سوق العقاري في البلد، لأنه هذا بجوز أكبر منا، بس ممكن تجارب زي هاي تمكننا من استغلال مساحات من الأرض اللي هلأ مش مستغلة. بتخيل إنها توفر مثلا وظيفة لكل شباب البلد صعب، لمعظم شباب البلد برضه صعب، بس هل ممكن نمط زي نمط كيف التعاونية الأخيرة اللي حكيت عنها، نمط زراعة الأشجار الفاكهة أو اللوزيات أو غيره، هذا نمط ما بده عمالة كتير، فممكن يكون نمط برضه على الهامش لكن بشكل منتج، يعني بيوظف عدد ممكن قليل من الناس أو عدد كبير بشكل موسمي، بيستغل أراضي اللي هي لساتها ضمن السوق، ولكن عبل ما تنباع الأرض أو عبل ما ينبنى عليها ممكن يتم استغلالها بشيء تاني. فأنا برأيي هون يعني هذا النوع من الهوامش اللي ممكن الشغل فيها على القليلة لحد ما يكون في استثمار بشكل مركزي وأكبر باستصلاح الأرض، اللي هو أوسع من قدرة التجارب هاي على إنها تعمله.
تفضل يا نتالي.
شكرا. أنا مش عارفة، بس مش عم بظبط معي أفتح الكاميرا. بحكي لي المشكلة من عند الهوست. بس مبدئيا كتير بهنيك على أستاذ فائق على هاي المحاضرة المهمة كتير، والموضوع تبع التعاونيات اللي بتهيأ لي كمان إنه أوكي اللي بتهيأ لي إنه رح يكون في مزيد من الاهتمام فيه، بخاصة بعد الأحداث اللي عمالنا بنشهدها. بس أنا بدي أسألك بشغلة لفتت نظري، وبحب يعني توضح لي إياها أكتر، لأنه بجوز أنا في عندي فهم معين للتعاونيات مختلف شوية. هلا أنت أثرت قضية كتير مهمة اللي هي التناقض الفكري اللي موجود في فكر هاي التعاونيات، بين إنه هي عندها على الجانب الاقتصادي بدها تربح وبدها الاستدامة الاقتصادية، وعلى الجانب الاجتماعي والسياسي هي بيكون تدعو لاقتصاد مقاوم والعودة للأرض ومقاومة الاستعمار. وبتقول إنه كأنه الناس هون اللي بالتعاونيات كأنه بصير في تناقض بين تحقيق هذا أو تحقيق يعني تحقيق الهدف الاقتصادي أو الهدف الاجتماعي والسياسي. فأنا مش فاهمة بالضبط إنه ليش بيكون في تناقض. يعني حسب فهمي أنا للجمعية التعاونيات هي مش مشروع اشتراكي، وهي شركة يعني هدفها بالآخر الربح، شركة تجارية وهدفها الربح، بس هي بتختلف عن الشركة الرأسمالية أو الشركات في النظام الرأسمالي، إنه حصة أي حدا بغض النظر عن قديش هو مساهم في حصة صغيرة من رأس المال في نظام داخلي ديمقراطي، إنه القرار يتخذ بالتساوي. بينما إنه هي شركة، هي مش جم التعاونيات هي مش جمعيات خيرية وهدفها تقديم بس المساعدة، لا، هي جزء أساسي من هدفها الربح. ف كيف التناقض بيصير؟ ايش التناقض بين الجانب الاقتصادي والجانب السياسي والاجتماعي؟ تشرح لنا اياه اكثر شويه اذا في مجال. وكمان بالنسبه للجانب النظري، ذكرت انت اعتمدت على مدرسه التبعيه والتقسيم، للتقسيم اللي هو مركز طرف، كجانب تنظيري مهم لفهم الاقتصاد السياسي في فلسطين. بس أنا اللي بدي أسألك هي إنه إحنا نعرف إنه نظرية التبعية هي نشأت في ستينيات القرن الماضي في سياق ما بعد الاستعمار. هلأ الحالة عندنا بفلسطين شوي كتير مركبة أكتر، يعني هي بتقدر تقول حالة استعمارية، وهو في نفس الوقت بعد ما أجت السلطة في عنا حالة ما بعد استعمارية. فقديش هذا الإطار النظري عن جد بخدمنا في الفهم؟ وشكرا لك مرة تانية، وأسف على الاستطالة.
شكرا لك على السؤال. هلا بالنسبة للاقتصادي والسياسي، أنا برأيي يعني أوكي ممكن ما نسميه تناقض، بس هو في هذا التنشن، خلينا نقول الموجود. وأول إشي يعني هو أنا اللي حكيته إنها هي مش تعاونيات بالمعنى التقني للعبارة، وبالتالي برأيي هي بتختلف عن النموذج اللي أنت قلتيه اللي هي زي شركة ولكن في تساوي بين أعضائها وفي العائد إنه بيتوزع عليهم والقرار بإيدهم. هي أكتر من هيك، لأنه التجارب هاي بدت برأيي بدت من سؤال سياسي ووطني قبل ما تبدأ من سؤال اقتصادي لأعضائها. والجانب الاقتصادي المادي كمردود للأعضاء هو فعليا هو التابع للسؤال الأول ومش العكس. فهي مش شركة اللي عندها تقدم يعني عندها contribution للنضال الوطني أو غيره أو للمجتمع. هي أقرب لأنها تكون لجنة اجتماعية اللي عم بتحاول تدخل دخل لأعضاء. فبرأيي هذا هيك ضروري نفهمه، عشان هيك مرات بحبش أسميهم تعاونيات عشان منفوت في يعني preconceptions لشو مفروض يكونوا من قيسهم عليها، بس هم شوي أبعد يعني أبعد من هيك عنها حتى لو بسموا حالهم تعاونية. هلا هاي النقطة الأولى. النقطة الثانية إنه شو يعني وين الصعوبة اللي بواجهوها؟ برأيي يعني أول إشي هم بواجهوا الصعوبة اللي أي منتج بهذا الحجم بواجهها بالسوق الفلسطيني. يعني أي منتج بحجمهم بده يضطر ينافس المنتجات الإسرائيلية أو منتجات التجار أو المنتجين الكبار بالسوق الفلسطيني، راح يكون عنده تحدي كبير. يعني ما عندك economies of scale، أنت مش عم تستغلي عمال، عندك كمية الاستغلال أصلاً اللي بتقدري تستغليها لعامل واحد أو اثنين راح تكون أقل. وبالتالي أنت يا إما بدك تبيعي أغلى من السوق ويخرب محصولك، يا إما بدك تستغلي نفسك فعلياً بأنك تشتغلي ساعات عمل أكتر أو بظروف مش مواتية علشان تقدري يعني تدبري حالك بالسوق. فهذا هو برأيي المستوى الأول من الصعوبة اللي بواجهوها اللي هي لها علاقة بحجمهم. بس كمان هم عندهم هدف إنه مثلا تكون الإنتاج صحي، ما يكون في سموم ومبيدات وإلى آخره. في منهم أورجانيك في منهم مش أورجانيك، بس بشكل عام يعني في نوع من الالتزام الأخلاقي تجاه البيئة وتجاه المجتمع وتجاه الناس اللي بيشتغلوا معهم وإلى آخره. هذا كمان بصعب الظرف، لأنه قدرتك على استغلال الناس أو البيئة بتصفي محدودة، أو إنه ما بدك تستغلي حدا. فهذا الحكي شو معناه؟ يا إما راح يطلع منتوجك أغلى يا إما راح تخسري. فهون في كمان جانب طبعا، غير إنه في المحاولة إنه أنت تقدمي للمجتمع المحلي سواء سلال غذائية أو غيره، أو إنك تبيعي بسعر السوق أو حتى أوطى أو ما تعتمدي على طلوع ونزول الأسعار وتحاولي تحافظي على سعر ثابت. كثير منهم بحاولوا يعملوا هيك، إنه إذا البندورة بثمانية شاكل وهي كانت بثلاثة، هم بضلهم على خمسة اللي هو سعر برأيهم بحاولوا يطلعوا منه من مؤثرات ومحددات السوق. فكل هاي الشغلات تحديات اللي أنت لو ما عندك، أو حتى لو ما بديتي من الهدف الأساسي هو هدف تحرري وغيره، كان ما بيكون عندك مشكلة معها. بيطلع السعر بنطلع سعرنا كمان وبنربح، بنحط مبيدات سامة مش مشكلة عشان نربح إلى آخره. فهي كلها محددات عندهم طبعا، غير إنه فكرة الوجود على الأرض زي ما حكيت، كثير من الأراضي هي أراضي سي يعني لسببين. هي من جهة لأنه هي الأراضي المتوفرة واللي ممكن الواحد يوصل لها واللي أرخص أو اللي أصحابها تاركينها، من جهة تانية كمان لأنه هذا هدف كان عند التعاونيات حماية هاي الأرض. فيعني برأيي في توليفة مختلفة من العوامل والأهداف اللي بتخلي موائمة الربح أو العائد المادي للأعضاء مع الهدف الوطني الأعم تحدي. بس أنا ما بشوفه كتحدي يعني بالمعنى السلبي، بالعكس بشوف إنه يعني هاي هي الظروف اللي إحنا عايشينها اليوم. يعني هو واضح إنه اللي كانوا مفكرين إنه ممكن يضلهم لجان تطوعية ويحموا الأرض بمساهمات من المجتمع وتطوع منهم إلى آخره، في حد في لحظة معينة لقوا إنه طب ما إحنا ما عندناش شغل، كيف بدي أتطوع وأنا ما عنديش دخل أصلاً؟ فصار مضطر إنه يلاقي كمان مرة توليفة اللي بيقدر يدخل لحاله دخل فيها، بس بنفس الوقت يحافظ على الدور السياسي الاجتماعي لإله. وبالتالي يعني بشوفها نوع من التعامل مع الظروف والمحددات اللي احنا عايشينها اليوم.
Thank you so much. I'm going to switch to English again. And we have a couple of more questions in English. One, so Rana, she has two questions. The first one is, are there cooperatives outside the agricultural sector? Could you elaborate more on this topic? So I suggest that we keep this question for the end because it's quite broad and it might take Fike a lot of time to develop. But I'll move on to the second question, which is more on climate change, I would say. And she asks, as agricultural produce are sometimes volatile and subject to weather conditions, how do the agricultural cooperatives shells, so do how do they protect themselves from bad seasons? Have they developed any consumer assisted program or something similar? And maybe I will combine this question with also the question of Samira. So I think maybe it's easier for you to give a like a global answer. Samira, she asks regarding the sustainability of these projects, do the cooperatives provide a living for farmers? Or do they need to rely on other sources of income, such as part-time jobs in cities in the West Bank? In other words, could the cooperatives be exclusive source of incomes and living for those farmers? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the questions. I forgot the one about dependency theory earlier, and I think it applies also with caveats, and given your question, of course, like we are living in a condition which is directly colonial, but also somewhat post-colonial. And yeah, so if we think about dependency theory, it cannot be like a rigid framework that we look through. But I think it is still valuable because there is a component of that in the current Palestinian economy. Okay, volatility and safety net. Yes, they have developed ways. I would say that in general, it's not institutionalized, but as a practice, it does exist, which is either the NGO Sharaka, which is in the Markaz al-Fanni al-Sha'bi, either they help in marketing the produce, or they try to compensate, or it will be through individual donations from people who are regular customers for the farmers market. So in a way, it's kind of an semi-institutionalized safety net that depends on consumers and also on people who donate. But also the idea of the, as I mentioned, the Solidarity Fund is a way that the cooperatives were thinking about producing this net themselves, so that they can like save up money in the seasons that are good so that they would protect themselves through it in seasons that are bad. But this has not really materialized yet. Sustainability, and yes, some of them are completely dependent on the cooperative, but many of them are not. So I think it is possible, but then you go to the specificities of each case, how much land they have access to, at what cost, whether water is available in their village or not, you know, whether they are taking funding or not. And therefore, it's difficult to generalize about all of them, but I would say that it is possible, and you can see that in multiple of the cooperatives I mentioned. Non-agricultural cooperatives, yes, there are. And actually, the two that started this trend, or not trend, but like that started the group that I mentioned, were coffee shops. And in my opinion, the idea was not like when it was conceived at the beginning or when it emerged in relation to the thought about resistance economy and so on, was not solely about food sovereignty and about agriculture, but it was more about generally the material basis for national liberation, you can say. And but in reality, agriculture was one of the most important and also easiest things to do in this regard, because the main, because the barrier to entry is low, especially in the countryside where land is available, as I said, even if it's lowly productive and etc. So the whole, like the whole experience here is trying to find a way into this kind of resistance economy while working within the margins of the condition today and what's possible. But and this is why basically the coffee shops that were in operation at first basically closed their doors. But it doesn't mean that no others exist. For example, one of the cooperatives mentioned here is in the Jalazon refugee camp, and it's more than, it does have an agricultural component, but it's actually a very impressive model of a circular economy where you have a shop, like a small market, and it has membership, and people who are members who buy from the market get points, and then through those points they can buy from a pharmacy. So in a way it is providing like an informal health insurance, especially to people with diabetes in the refugee camp. And then, you know, it has a section where it sells cooperative agricultural produce. So it works in, and then recently they expanded to get their own lands. And so the model does exist beyond agriculture. It's rarer because, as I said, the barrier to entry in agriculture is lower. But there was an attempt, or there is still an attempt at what's called an engineering commune. So like a cooperative model for architects and engineers. And probably I forgot one or two, but yes, so it exists, although most are agricultural.
Thank you. So I think that there is Raya who wants to ask a question, and then Ahmad as well will ask a question. And we have around 15 minutes left, so we will let those two questions and then wrap up the session. And
there is another question on the chat, and I have one also.
Okay, so we need to be quick both in the questions and answers. Thank you. So I'll let Raya speak first and then Ahmad. Thank you.
مرحبا يعطيك العافية وشكرا على اللقاء المهم. سريعا يعني بحب تطرق لكيف انه لما احنا نحكي على كل مفهوم الزراعة التحررية والشكل اللي عم تاخده هاي المبادرات انه هي تمشي بمسار الزراعة التحررية، احنا بالضرورة نتطرق لهذا الاشي كقضية جمعية ومسؤولية جمعية. وبشوف انه كمان حتى التحديات اللي تطرقت لها هي مهمه، ولكن التحديات لا تسقط فقط على هدول المبادرات، ولكن على المجتمع ككل، كيف احنا ممكن نطلع من الاستهلاك النمطي ونفكر انه احنا في عندك حتى نمط الاستهلاك هو ممكن يكون استهلاك تحرري بالمعنى الاكبر لكل قضيه الزراعه التحرريه. والنقطه الثانيه اللي بحب اتعقب عليها، انت لما حكيت على التحديات بالاخص لهاي المبادرات، انا بشوف بالعكس انه هدول المبادرات هم عندهم اقل تحديات اذا احنا بنطلع على الفلاح او المزارع او الفلاحه العاديه، لان هدول ابتكروا وسائل وطرق للتسويق مختلفه اللي خلتهم يقدروا يوصلوا للمستهلكين بطريقه مختلفه. على سبيل المثال، من احدى الشغلات اللي هم ركزوا عليها هي الزراعه المدعومه مجتمعيا، وهي العلاقه المباشره ما بين المنتج وما بين المستهلك. فالسؤال انه كيف ممكن احنا نعمم هاي العلاقه اللي هي مباشره من دون الوسطاء، لانه كمان الوسطاء هم احد اكبر المشاكل في كل ما يتعلق بالقطاع الزراعي والمشاكل اللي بيواجهوها الفلاحين والمزارعين. شكرا.
أحمد تكمل، شو رأيك فائق؟
أجاوب
أعطي مجال
أجاوب
نسأل
تمام
زي
بجاوب
ما بدك.
سريعا.
أوكي
يعني رأيي بصراحة أنا بتفق معك، وإذا بين إنه مش متفق معك بكون ما عرضتش منيح، بس أنا بتفق معك، هي تحديات مجتمعية أعم، وبالعكس أنا اللي بقوله إنه هاي التجارب هي ممكن تكون زي كشاف لإلنا اللي من خلاله نشوف المجتمع شو ممكن يعمل علشان يواجه هاي التحديات. وهذا الحكي بينطبق على اللي قلتيه عن كنموذج ممكن يساعد الفلاح بشكل أعم. هلأ أنا اللي كنت أقوله إنه برأيي من الأشياء المفيدة اللي من تجارب هاي التعاونيات هو الثقة اللي بتنبنى أو اللي ممكن تنبنى داخليا وبرضه مع المجتمع. ويعني السؤال، هل ممكن إنه هاي التعاونية اللي موجودة في قرية معينة يكون إلها دور في تنظيم أو في تنسيق العمل مع باقي الفلاحين ومساعدة في تسويق مثلا منتجاتهم ضمن الشبكات اللي هاي التعاونيات بنتها؟ برأيي هذا، يعني هذا إشي بسوى الواحد يعني يشتغل عليه، وهو فعليا موجود. يعني أكثر من حدا من هدول التعاونيات صار عم بشارك المعرفة والخبرة اللي عنده وكمان الأدوات أو غيرها مع فلاحين مجاورين لهم، وبالتالي كمان مرة يعني بتفق معك 100%. خلينا نوقف هون.
بليز أحمد.
شكرا فايق، يعني عن جد يعني كانت محاضرة مثرية صراحة. إن أنا اشتغلت على التعاونيات الشبابية بالتحديد، وقدمت ورقة كنت في السنة الماضية في بيروت وجمعت البيانات بال2023. المفروض أنتهي من الورقة نفس يعني خلال كم من شهر. الصراحة كمان يعني بتخيل إنه في كم من شغلة، إنه يعني في نوع من الرومانسية تجاه مفهوم التعاونية. وللأسف الشديد التعاونية التقليدية وخصوصا الزراعية لحد كبير في كتير تقليدية، مش كتير ظابطة في الوضع الحالي. وكأنه هدول الشباب من خلال هذا النموذج من التعاونيات قدروا يخلقوا سؤال حول مفهوم التعاونية نفسه، يعني شو هو التعاونية؟ ولأنه كمان هم عم بيشتغلوا بروح التعاونية بنمط أكثر متحرر من قيود التعاونية بالنمط التقليدي تاعها. وأنت كمان يمكن أشرت إشي زي هيك. الإشي الثاني إنه السؤال الاقتصادي لهدول الشباب حاضر، ويمكن حاضر يعني بقوة، ولكن له محدداته يعني وله معاييره. إنه شو اللي شو يعني يعني شو الاقتصاد، يعني شو معنى الربح، وكيف احنا بدنا نطور. والسؤال انه وحاضر يمكن بشكل انه يعني تجلياته بتظهر من السعي الدائم لابتكار ادوات ووسائل جديده على قضيه التسويق. يعني هم الثاني، يعني هذا الشيء الثاني. الشيء الثالث انه قديش هم عم يعني كانت يعني بالنمط الى حد كبير الزراعه اللي هو بيستخدموها، انه هو كمان في حاضنة كانت مبنية بشكل او باخر، اللي هم كمان بنوا على هاي التجربة تاعتهم يعني من قضية الزراعة العضوية. وبالتالي كمان انه كان في حاضنة ثقافية كمان، اللي هم شافوا انه هم كمان مندمجين فيها وحاولوا كمان اللي كمان غير انه كمان هو يعني هي يعني مدموجه بكثير عوامل، قضيه التحرر وقضيه المقاومه وهذا، وكمان انه هم كمان لقوا حالهم فيها، يعني قضيه الزراعه العضويه وكيف استفادوا من تجربه سعد داغر وكيف انهم هم طوروا مفاهيم، وكمان قضيه الاغتراب انهم هم طول الوقت عم بيطوروا معرفه لا يكونوا غير مغتربين عن النشاط اللي عم بيقوموا فيه. الشيء الاخير كمان انه انهم هم كمان عندهم مصادر اقتصاديه لحد كبير، يعني جزء كبير منهم انهم غير التعاونيات، وبالتالي هم كمان عم بيحاولوا يخلقوا مصادر لتحسين سبل العيش تاعتهم، وبشكل آخر وما يرهقوا التعاونيات بشكل اقتصاديا، وبالتالي هذا وبالتالي بس انه كمان كنت حابب يعني قديش هم قدروا يخلقوا مفهوم جديد يتجاوز مفهوم التعاونية التقليدية لحتى يتحرروا منها ويقدروا يكونوا ناجحين، وبيروقراطية السلطة وقضايا كتير أشياء اللي كمان يمكن إنها تؤدي إلى هاي التعاونيات ما تقدرش تستمر. وكمان بنشوف إنه في تعاونيات كتير زراعية إنه هي مش يعني موجودة على الورق، مش موجودة على أرض الواقع يعني.
شكرا أحمد على النقاط، يعني مهمين. وشوف أنا يعني برأيي زي ما حكيت إنه إحنا المشكلة إذا بنبدأ نفكر في هاي التجارب كتعاونيات ومنصير نشوف كيف عم بحاولوا يطلعوا من نموذج التعاونيات، برأيي هو الموضوع معكوس. هم ما بدوا كتعاونيات، وهم عم بوقعوا في شركة تعاونيات ونموذجها اللي موجود، وعم و ومرات يعني في لحظات هيك، في ومضات من خلينا نحكي الوضوح، يعني الواحد بيرجع ل شو كان جذر الفكرة، بس كتير مرات بتلاقي حالك عم تغرق في يعني مفهوم التعاونية مع انك انت ما بدتش من هناك. فأنا برأيي انه فعليا احنا مش لازم تكون نقطة بدايتنا لقراءتهم هي مفهوم التعاونية. يعني انا فعلا بشوف انه هذه التجارب اللي هي بدت ك هي أقرب للجان تطوعية، هي أقرب للجان مجتمعية، ودخلت جانب مدر للدخل، وبالتالي لقت إنه مفهوم التعاونية هو الأقرب على هذا الحكي. بس بعدين صار المفهوم بنفسه بقوته، مش بس بقوته كمفهوم كمان، يعني هو بمين اللي بيمثل هذا المفهوم بالبلد، أنهم NGOs عم بتدعم في فكرة التعاونيات، مين اللي عم بيحكي في تعاونيات اليوم، مين اللي عم بيعطي فاندنج لتعاونيات. هذا بصف اللي بيسحبك، سواء سلطة ولا أوكسفام ولا غيره يعني. فأنت بترجع بتغرق في موضوع الأنجزة اللي بداية هاي الفكرة كانت الهروب منها. وهلأ يعني أنا هون ما حكيت عن هذا الموضوع، بس أنا برأيي يعني كثير من هاي التجارب هي بدايتها كانت الحركات الشبابية، خلينا أقول في 2011 اللي هو كان حراك مطلبي بالأول، بعدين استوعب إنه إحنا ما بنقدر نطالب، احنا لازم نبني بنية، يعني نبني قاعدة المجتمع اللي بنسعى له كمجتمع تحرري. وبالتالي واحد من التوجهات كان التوجه الإنتاجي أو الاقتصادي اللي تمثل في تعاونيات، ولكن من التوجهات الثانية كان توجه ثقافي وتوجه اجتماعي وإلى آخره، اللي أخذت أشكال تنظيمية مختلفة. هلأ تم قمع هذيك الأشكال، وبالتالي ظل الجانب التعاوني وكمان أو الجانب الإنتاجي، والجانب الإنتاجي هذا خسر البنية المحيطة فيه اللي كانت تذكره إنه هو مش بس اقتصادي، فبرضه شوي انسحب أكتر في الجانب الاقتصادي، بس هو جذوره ومسعاه لسه لليوم برأيي هو بيرجع لهذيك التجربة، واللي هي صيرورتها لسه مستمرة. هلأ برأيي موضوع العلاقة بين الجانب الاقتصادي والسياسي هون بحد ذاته، يعني بحد ذاته هو موضوع للمساءلة في اللي عم نشوفه، حتى لو مش بشكل واعي عم بيطرح السؤال زي هيك. بس برأيي التجربة اللي قدامنا يعني، والمحاولات اللي يعني بتخيل مع بعض احنا عم نحاول يعني نفكر فيها، هي مش بس مساءلة لكيف نخلي السياسي والاقتصادي يزبطوا عنا مع بعض في البلد، هي مساءلة للفصل أصلا ما بين السياسي والاقتصادي. وشو معنى إنك تكون يعني خلينا نحكي فايبل اقتصاديا إذا أنت سياسيا عم تنتحر كمجتمع. ف برأيي هذا الفصل يعني فلسفيا كمان هو يعني قيد المساءلة في هاي التجارب، ومسؤوليتنا أنه نضلنا نفكر في هاي النقطة علشان ما نغرق بهاي زي ثنائية كيف بدي أوائم احتياجات السوق مع فكرة إني بدي أحرر البلد. هو فعليا إحنا لازم نطلع من هاي الثنائية أصلا ونفكر أوسع منها. وبرأيي هذا موضوع مش فلسطيني بحت كمان، يعني هو موضوع له علاقة في مستقبل الإنسانية كلها. وبالتالي اللي عم نفكر فيه هون، هم إحنا عم نفكر في هذا السؤال الفلسفي الوجودي الإنساني ضمن الرأسمالية المتأخرة من موقع فلسطيني وبخصوصية فلسطين، ولكن السؤال أعم من هيك. فهذا يعني هذا رأيي بشكل عام.
إيه، شكرا كثير. ما ضلش وقت كثير، فأنا مش عارف إذا يعني هحكي اللي عندي ونشوف إذا في مجال تجاوب أو بنخلي موضوع هيك مفتوح للتفكير. كنت بدي أقول لك أول إشي شكرا كثير على المداخلة وعلى أجوبتك. برأيي أنا كثير مهم هاي السردية اللي عندك إياها للتجربة، اللي مش عم نسمعها كثير، وبرأيي يعني جد مهم انها تبرز. فبشجعك يعني انك تكمل وتكتب وتخلينا دائما نعرف اكثر عن هذا الموضوع. انا لفتني الموضوع اللي انت بدأت فيه، اللي هو موضوع التهميش، اللي ما رجعنا حكينا فيه، بس انت وكأنه يعني عم تحكي انه التهميش هون كان دوره مش بس انه هو سبب لهذا النوع من التجربة، كمان هو اللي سمح لهيك تجربة تقدر تكون موجودة. فهذا الشيء كان ملفت، إنه قديش كان في مجال هاي التجربة تتواجد لو بمكان أكثر مركزي. ولهون بجي لسؤالي، ملاحظتي، إحنا ما حكيناش عن دور السلطة بهاي التجربة. شو علاقتها بهيك تجربة؟ قديش عم بتسهل أو عم بتعطل أو عم بت ملاش علاقة بالمرة؟ ولما بحكي السلطة يعني مش بس عم نحكي على مستوى السلطة يعني والحكومة، حتى ممكن على مستوى السلطات المحلية، يعني البلديات هل لها دور أو ما لهاش دور، المحافظة إلى آخره. يعني هل في دور معين لأي جهة حكومية رسمية عامة، خلينا نقول، بدعم هاي التجربة لحتى ممكن ما تضلش على الهامش، وتقدر كمان هي يعني ممكن تكون وسيلة لحتى التجربة تتعمم. كان عندي كمان السؤال، أنت حكيت شوي بمداخلتك عن العلاقة أو اللا علاقة مع موضوع الصناعات الزراعية، فكنت بدي أسأل أكثر عن هذا الإشي. هل في تجارب يعني استفادوا، يعني الشباب كانوا بالقطاع الزراعي خلينا نقول التقليدي، يعني راحوا حولوا لهذا النوع من التعاونيات، أو العكس، الشباب بلشوا بالتعاونيات وبعد هيك يمكن كملوا أو بلاش كملوا، حولوا لموضوع الـ يعني الصناعة الزراعية التقليدية؟ هل من ناحية البضائع أو من ناحية التجارب في أي إشي كمان ممكن يعني نحكي إنه في علاقة بين هالقطاعين، أو هم عن جد قطاعين منفصلين تماما عن بعض؟ ولا هيك بس كمان هيك، لأنه كان في سؤال مكتوب ما قرأناهوش، بيحكي كونك مطلع على التجربة، هل بتشوف أنه عاملين بالتعاونيات مهتمين بتطوير تكنولوجيا زراعية يعني بتتلائم مع سياقنا، أم هم بس مستهلكين لتكنولوجيا السوق اللي موجودة، يعني الأسمدة، المبيدات، أو العدة الزراعية؟ فنحن هيك بالضبط يعني صارت 1:30. هاي عرفت إذا نعطيك مجال تجاوبي بشكل سريع أو إذا خلص
لا لا، من بحاول بشكل سريع. طيب، بالنسبة للموضوع، نبدأ من الآخر. موضوع التكنولوجيا في محاولات، نعم، ويعني وأحمد حكى عن الموضوع، قال مثلا عن سعد داغر ودوره في التجربة وإلى آخره، وكمان أكثر من حدا من أعضاء هاي التعاونيات هو مهندسين زراعيين أو بدرسوا هندسة زراعية، وبالتالي يعني بالنسبة لهم هذا الموضوع هو محوري، ففي تطوير لهذا الشغل. في كمان استخدام يعني لتكنولوجيا من خلال مشاريع الان جي اوز وغيره، يعني انه بايوغاس وابصر شو، فهذا موجود على الجهتين كاستهلاك وكمحاولة تطوير. من ناحية الاجري بزنس، شوف، برأيي الموضوع يعني بيستاهل يعني التمحيص أكتر، ما مش راح أقدر أعطي جواب نهائي، بس هو بالنسبة لي كان ملفت إنه واحدة من التعاونيات الأولى اللي بطلت ضمن المجموعة هي كانت في بلدة زراعية أصلاً، وكان يعني تقديري إنه متاح لإلها فكرة الإنتاج المربح يعني كبزنس، ولكن كان فكرة التعاونية هي طريقة لأنه تجيب لهذا الإنتاج فاندينج من مؤسسات. فيعني الشباب كانوا عاملين الزراعة كبزنس، وبنفس الوقت الزراعة كإشي لاستقدام الفاندينج، وبالآخر طلعت البزنس موفي أكتر. بس هذا الحكي في محل اللي هو أصلا يعني سهل زي مرج بن عامر، في باقي المحلات مش راح يزبطوا. عشان هيك أنا كنت بقول إنه تقديري يعني اللي عم بقوله انه هاي التعاونيات موجودة في اماكن اللي اصلا الزراعة فيها مش مجدية لهالدرجة، لو انها مجدية كان ما بيكون في هذا الهامش. وعشان هيك وهون بنرجع لنقطتك الاولى، هو موضوع الهامش وكيف انه شكل فرصة. وبرأيي يعني هو فعلا هاي هي التناقضات. يعني اذا بتطلع انت اليوم وين اكثر الاماكن في الضفة تهميشا، اذا بدنا ناخذ المؤشرات اللي انا هيك عرفتها في البداية، نطلع على البطالة، العمل خارج اللوكاليتي والى اخره، اذا بنرجع للجرافس اللي عرضتها بنشوف ان المخيمات طبعا اكثر شيء مهمش، وبنفس الوقت اذا بنطلع على الحاله النضاليه اليوم بنشوف ان المخيمات هي انشط بؤر في النضال. وبرايي الموضوع شبيه في موضوع الزراعه يعني، بس بعوامل او يعني بظروف شوي مختلفه، انه فعليا الاماكن الاكثر تهميشا هي اللي الناس فيها اول شيء عندهم اقل يخسروا، عندهم هامش اكثر للحركه في مناطق اللي السلطه دورها فيها اقل، سواء لأنه يعني فرض عليها هذا الحكي بحكم أوسلو ألف باجيم، ولا بحكم تركيبة المنطقة ديموغرافيا وتنظيميا وإلى آخره، وبالتالي بتصفي هي الأماكن اللي فيها مجال وهامش أكثر للمناورة. هلأ يعني الفكرة هون أنه نقرأ هذا الحكي بهاي العلاقة الجدلية ما بين الظروف اللي عم تقمع أو عم بتدمر في هاي الحالة الجانب الإنتاجي في المجتمع، ولكن بنفس الوقت في سعيها لتدميره هي بتخلق هوامش للعمل. وبرأيي هذا مهم. هلأ برجع لواحد من الأسئلة اللي متروكة هون، إنه هل يعني هل هاي التجارب راح تضلها هي فقاعات اللي عم تشتغل يعني مبسوطة على حالها في هذا الهامش؟ برأيي وهذا مسؤولية هذا السؤال، يعني هو مش محسوم، مسؤوليته علينا وعلى التجارب نفسها. يعني الناس اللي بتشتغل وبتفكر على الأرض كيف إنها تحاول تضل تذكر حالها إنه مش هذا هو الهدف، وبالتالي كيف ممكن يتوسع هذا الهامش، كيف ممكن اللي أنا أبنيه اليوم يعني زي يضرب إسفين اللي يوسع الهامش اللي عم بشتغل فيه. يعني صعب هلأ نجاوب، بس سؤالك على دور السلطة، وهو فعلا يعني أنا هذا بالضبط اللي كنت بحكيه، إنه التجربة بدأت من المركز، يعني بدأت من رام الله. حتى إذا بدك نحكي يعني، وهذا اللي بحكيه أكثر بالدكتوراه، إنها هي بدأت من مركز المركز، فأنا برجعها للحراكات، بدأت من مركز رام الله اللي هو المنارة كحراك مطلبي، انتقلت من المنارة كحراك مطلبي وكفضاء عام لفضاءات خاصة أكثر اللي هي حاولت تبني فيها زي ما قلت البنية الإنتاجية والبنية المعرفية. بس حتى هاي الفضاءات اللي هي سيمي برايفت برضه انقمعت لأنها لسه قريبة على المركز اللي هو رام الله، وبالتالي تفرعطت التجربة لأماكن هامشية أكتر، ولكن وين ممكن تنجح أكتر. بس برضه حددت بأنها صفت تجربة أكتر إنتاجية زراعية من ما كانت ثقافية ومعرفية وإلى آخره إلى آخره. فالحركة هاي من المركز للهامش برأيي هي يعني على القليلة في سرديتي للي بيصير هي أساسية. دور السلطة بشكل مباشر أو بشكل غير مباشر يعني اللي بخلي المركز زي رام الله هو مش مواتي، مش بس إنه في قمع، بس كمان إنه في مغريات. يعني إذا أنت ساكن في رام الله في عندك بدائل كتيرة، على الأغلب أنت تعليمك أحسن، على الأغلب الفرص الشغل أحسن، على الأغلب إنه إمكانية الترفيه أعلى. بالتالي أنت لما يجي حدا يقول لك والله رفعنا الأجار للمكان اللي أنت مستأجره ولا اطلع، ما عندك نفس الدوافع إنك تقول لا مش طالع، زي حدا اللي ما كان عنده شغل أصلاً ومضطر لهذا الحكي. فبرأيي يعني كمان لما نحكي عن المركز ومواتي ولا مش مواتي، هو مش بس الفكرة إنه والله إذا عملت تعاونية بدي أكسر راسك، مش هيك الموضوع. بس يعني هي كل الظروف هاي اللي عشان هيك أنا برأيي لما بحكي يعني بحاول أحكي التهميش، بمعنى إنه نحاول نفهم كمان مرة نتجاوز ما بين الفصل ما بين الاقتصادي والسياسي، ونفهم التركيبة الحياتية اللي إحنا عايشين فيها وين كل هاي العوامل متداخلة. وفكرة التهميش هون هي جاي بتجمع ما بين دور السلطة، دور رأس المال، دور إسرائيل اللي كله عم بينتج لنا هاي الواقع اللي إحنا عايشينه. وبرأيي سؤالك الأخير بده يعني بده بحث كمان أكتر، مش بس يعني مش بس إجابة أطول، اللي هو الدور العملي للهيئات المحلية أو للأجسام السياسية في كيف ساعدت أو ضرت، أو شو كانت تجربة التعاونيات هاي والأجسام الأعم من تعاونيات كمان معها. يعني برأيي هذا ضروري نفكر فيه كمان نحكي عنه لقدام.
So thank you so much. We have run out of time, so I think we need to wrap up this session here. Thank you so much, Faik, for the wonderful presentation and for the discussion. I think that we would have need more time to discuss with you, but hopefully we will have the opportunities in the next sessions to continue our conversation on Palestinian agriculture, agricultural development, and alternatives, cooperatives, and all what's happening on the ground. So just a quick reminder, our next session will be on the 21st of April. It will be with Feruz Salem, and it will start at 1 p.m. Jerusalem time, so around, I guess, 11 UK time. We will soon share the link, the Zoom link, on our institutional pages. So please do register for our next session. And thank you everyone for attending this session. It has been a great pleasure, and hope to see you at the next session.